Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Spoke here a few weeks ago, but I'm noticing it has a very different feeling tonight. And I think part of it might be nighttime as opposed to the day. I just spoke on a Saturday morning, maybe other factors, but I'm really appreciating the intimacy of the event. I'm just so grateful to each of you for having come tonight to spend this time together with us. I also want to thank Teresa, who extended the invitation to me to speak. This is actually a rescheduled talk. I mentioned this when I spoke a few weeks ago. This is a rescheduled talk for a talk that I was originally invited to give at the end of April, but that I had to cancel at the last minute because I had to go to the emergency room, because I was at risk of having an immediate heart attack. And I might say a few more words about that, but I want to express some more gratitudes first. So thank you for Teresa for the original invitation and then for rescheduling for tonight. And I just want to thank the entire Canando community, because actually I think anything like this that happens, someone ends up on this seat, is actually due to everyone's activity in the community. We may not be aware of that, but I think that's actually how it works. So I just want to thank the whole community for allowing and supporting me to give this talk here tonight. I appreciate it. You know, and I think it's also in accord with Buddhist understanding to say the entire universe is in fact supporting and allowing every moment of experience to happen the way it's happening. And so I want to express my gratitude for the entirety of the universe, entirety of being, to support me to be here tonight and to give this talk. And, you know, and then, you know, it's kind of a Zen slogan, so we can say it easily without maybe, you know, and it's helpful to say it however we say it, but maybe without feeling like the full reality of it. So this kind of Zen slogan sometimes are saying like, just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough. So this feels quite real to me these days because of what I was saying a few moments ago, that at the end of April, completely out of the blue for me, I went to an urgent care center with a bad cough. And they did a chest x-ray and found that there was fluid in my lungs. And then they, I guess that's a sign of possible congestive heart failure. And so then they did an EKG and my heart was just like, I guess, racing off the charts. I mean, they didn't say exactly, but they just said, you need to go to the emergency right away. So I was taken to the emergency room, and it was unlike my imagination of what an emergency room visit would be like. I haven't made many, at least not in recent years, but I kind of imagine like you go to the emergency room and then you just wait for hours, right, to be seen. That's the stereotype, I think, of emergency rooms. And it was the exact opposite in my case. I showed up, I checked in, and like I had barely sat down, literally. It was just like a minute or two, and they called my name to see me. And I think it was because they didn't want me having a heart attack in the waiting room. I was at immediate risk. And so I went in and they started getting information about me, and then the emergency room doctor came in to see me. I don't know if she was a cardiologist or just the ER doctor, but she came in, and I think the nurse had like just asked me what my birthday was. And so my birthday is July 9th, 1970. And the ER doctor says to me, oh, that's my birthday. And then she says, the last patient who had my birthday had a heart attack. So I think this is like the kind of gallows humor that emergency room doctors just like develop to like get through their work. But it was a little startling to be greeted that way. But I told her I was fine. I'm a Zen priest, so I'm taken care of. I wasn't worried. Anyway, it turned out, I mean, I won't give you I've given you some details because I actually wanted you to get some feeling of the reality of this event. This isn't in my notes for the talk. I'm sorry I wasn't able to join you for this sitting. I know that's the customary practice. I hadn't really put anything to paper for the talk yet, so I wanted some time just to outline the talk. And I hadn't really intended to give this much time for it, but then as I was waiting outside, I realized this maybe that might be the most important thing, like to face one's death in such a real way. Maybe this happens more often than I realize. Anyway, I'd never had an experience like this. And also what I realized is that it didn't take very long afterwards, like within a few months, that I'd already started to kind of forget the intensity of the experience. And I have a good friend of mine who I talk with, who's also a psychologist, and she noticed, like just a few months after the event, that I would refer to the event, or I'd say that I had told someone else about the event, and that I would call it my heart event, you know. And then you know, during the heart event, and she keeps bringing my attention back to like, that's an inadequate description. That's an inadequate description of what you went through. You had a life-threatening open heart surgery after having a life-threatening, you know, problem with your heart. And so it's being brought to my attention, like, even though I just went through this months ago, that how quickly the psyche starts to like obscure that to some degree. Obscure that, how, anyway, my psyche, it seems, is obscuring how close I was to death. And I guess I can only speak for myself, but I wonder about this being like a general human phenomenon, right? And again, this is like such basic central Buddhist teaching, right? All conditioned things are of the nature to dissolve, to come apart. We are all of the nature to experience sickness, old age, and death. This will happen to each of us. And given that reality, which was a startling reality for the Buddha, as we hear, whether that's historical or mythological, this kind of startling realization he had of this truth of human life, what does that mean for how we want to live our life? And I've gotten closer to it in the talk tonight, which I appreciate. I guess that started to become my intention. Like, well, could I use the talk as an opportunity to get closer to this reality? But kind of what I was saying was that in daily life already, I notice I'm forgetting. I'm skirting around it. I'm avoiding that. And I think because it was just completely out of the blue, there really was a sense of like, this could happen to anyone at any time. Again, this is a Buddhist teaching, like we're all of the nature to die and we don't know when that's gonna happen. So we hear this as kind of like an abstract teaching, but it was like, no, this is real. So thank you for allowing me to use this opportunity to become more intimate with my own experience. And may it facilitate each of your capacity and ability to be intimate with your own life, your own experience. That's my wish for you. So I do want to say just a few more words because there's something actually about one of the procedures that was done on me, which I think is very interesting just medically in its the actual medical technology, like of what they did. And then also, for whatever reason, it carried like very powerful kind of metaphorical meaning for me. So I want to share that. So so I was diagnosed with a mitral valve disease. It's called Barlow's mitral valve disease. And it actually, it, you know, like the perfect demographic, I guess it most often strikes men in their early 50s. It's a degenerative disease of the valve. It can, there can be symptoms leading up to it, but, you know, as in my case, it can also just, you know, you can become aware of it suddenly, you know. And the main symptom of the disease is that the excessive tissue grows on the valve. So there's like, in my case, there was like a flap of tissue coming off the valve that was flapping back and forth, and then it would flap back into the valve, and then the valve couldn't close properly. And so it was just spurting out blood. It was just badly, badly. And the medical term was regurgitating, leaking. And I guess that also is related to why my lungs were filling with fluid. But then I, because of that, or, you know, related to that, probably because of that, I also had an atrial fibrillation. I lost my normal heartbeat. So my heart was racing. It was going very, very fast. And it was had an irregular beat. It didn't have a regular beat. So when I went into the emergency room, the first, you know, because it, like they just wanted to take care of the immediate emergency, which was the risk of a heart attack, they treated the atrial fibrillation and the racing heart rate. They just wanted to calm my heart down and steady the rhythm, and which they did fairly successfully. I never came out of AFib the entire time I was in the hospital, or even afterwards for a while. That was partly what I'm talking about. And then eventually they diagnosed the valve. And so and I needed open heart surgery. So the main purpose of the surgery, of course, was to repair. We didn't know going in if it was going to be repair or replace the valve, but they were able to repair it, which was a much better outcome from my point of view. But the other thing I was told ahead of time that they would do after they had severed my sternum and pried open my rib cage and deflated my lungs and put me on a lung machine and stopped my heart and put me on a heart machine so they operate on my heart. So in addition to the main thing they were doing, which was to deal with the valve, however they were going to do that, I was told ahead of time they also wanted to do, it has the most amazing name, they wanted to do what's called a maze procedure, like M-A-Z-E, just like you would think, like a maze, like going through a labyrinth. And so this was to hopefully, this was to treat the AFib, to hopefully try and get me back in regular rhythm. And so you might think maze procedure was probably named after like Dr. Maze, but no, I think it's named after what happens when they do the procedure. So what they do is, so the heartbeat, I guess, is primarily an electromagnetic event. So that's what's causing the heart to beat is electromagnetic current going through it. And so the maze procedure is they intentionally, like using lasers, they intentionally wound. So they intentionally wound the heart. They like put like actually like a maze pattern. I guess the wounding or the scarring is like in a maze pattern in the heart, which disrupts, the intention is that it will disrupt the rhythm of the heart so that it'll need to kind of like find a new rhythm. And when it finds a new rhythm, it'll go back to the normal rhythm. That's the intention of the procedure. So they did this maze procedure, which didn't actually immediately return me to normal rhythm. They had to cardiovert me later. But the maze procedure like started to, as I say, kind of take on this metaphorical meaning. Like I it made me kind of wonder about, in a more general metaphorical sense, about finding oneself having gotten out of one's, let's say, natural rhythm of being, the rhythm of who you really are, who we really are, who I really am. This happens to us. We lose our way. We lose our natural way. And there's so many societal pressures that contribute to this, but for many reasons. And then often it takes a kind of like wounding of the heart, a scarring of the heart to kind of bring that to our attention. And this is also often, I think, what brings people to Zen practice. They've gotten out of rhythm in their life, and then there's some event that's a serious wounding of the heart and scarring of the heart that forces them to kind of like reset their rhythm. And then there's that potential to kind of reset the rhythm in accord with who you really are. Or, you know, in the heart's case, with the natural rhythm. But in this metaphorical sense, there's the opportunity to kind of reset in terms of who you really are, let's say. And I think that really is like my favorite Suzuki Roshi teaching. You know, when you become you, Zen becomes Zen. I misquoted that for many years. I thought it was when you are you, Zen is Zen. When you are you, Zen is Zen. But it's actually, I looked it up, it's when you become you, Zen becomes Zen. And I appreciate that sense of becoming, that sense of constant flowing and evolving and always evolving in the direction of who we are, who we truly are. So when you become you, Zen becomes Zen. So I guess if I have a second wish to offer you all after, you know, wishing for your, you know, becoming intimate with your life and experience, my wish is may you all become who you really are. Please, for all of us. All right, well, maybe that's enough about my heart. As I said, I hadn't intended to say so many words, but there was a lot in there for me. I did a half day sitting over the weekend with Ed Brown, a Zen teacher who lives in Fairfax. And after we all sat together for the morning, we had all had lunch together. And before the lunch, I was changing out of my robes from the sitting and into kind of my civvies for the meal. And a woman came over to me to greet me. Ed also has an online sitting group in the mornings that I often participate in as this other woman, Maureen. So we know each other from the online sitting group, but we'd never been in person together. So she just came over because she wanted to say hello and just say how happy was to see me. I mean, she knew what had happened, to kind of see me in person, that I was there that day. And I said, well, would it alarm you if I showed you my scar? She said, no, I would love to see your scar. And so I had my robes on, so I just kind of opened up the, you know, the what's it called? Anyway, the Japanese white shirt that goes under the kimono and the kimono, the juban. Yeah, I opened up the juban under the kimono and the kimono. And I, you know, so I have like a foot long, you know, scar and she touched it, you know, she was very gently. I mean, it was such a, I started crying, you know, this is again kind of like speaking to how hard it is to be present for an event like this, to be present in real time for it, and then maybe to be present over time for it. Because only the second time I'd kind of shed tears about this, but this was, you know, obviously a traumatic thing. The other time was like a week or so earlier. I was in my closet and I took down the plastic breathing machine that they give you when you come out of the surgery, when you need to reinflate your lungs, you breathe into the sink to start to build back up. And I was looking for something else and I took it down and I just broke into sobs when I took this thing down. I think just the association of like, that was the hardest thing for me when I came out of the surgery, was starting to breathe again, like getting my lungs to work again. So that all said, I am so glad to be here tonight, and just to be alive is enough. But it's, you know, I feel like it's so much more than just being alive to be here tonight. It feels, to me anyway, especially auspicious because it's just a day after the full moon, So we had this full moon yesterday, right around the time that the talk started. It was around 7:35 last night. And many of you may know this, I've already seen some nodding heads, but it was a very rare moon because there was a synchronistic coincidence of three events. So it was a full moon that was the harvest moon. So the harvest moon is the name for the September moon, which happens to be closest to the autumn equinox. And it was named the harvest moon because I guess historically, traditionally, the light of the full moon was enough that farmers could actually harvest. There was enough light to harvest the fields. This is the hot time of year when you do harvesting, and they could harvest at night by the full moon. So it was the harvest moon. But I think also because of the tilt of the earth, the moon appears to rise much more quickly than other moons. So it was the harvest moon. And then also there was a partial lunar eclipse. So that means the earth was blocking some of the light of the sun onto the moon. So that gave the moon a kind of reddish tint. So it was, which is called a blood moon. So it was the harvest moon, and it was also the blood moon. And coincidentally, this moon also happened at a time where it was closer to the earth than normal. Like the closest the earth gets, the moon gets to the earth, which makes the moon appear larger than usual, which is called a supermoon. So it was the harvest moon, a blood moon, and a supermoon last night. And for those of us, who practice Zen, the full moon's a big deal. So this was like full moon extraordinaire. I'm on the Dharma seat the day after the triple celestial event of the full moon. And that did put me in mind of the full moon ceremony, which is a traditional practice in Zen temples, and which I practiced for many, many years, ritually, regularly, every month at the time of the full moon, usually scheduled as close to the actual full moon as possible. And it's the time each month where Buddhist practitioners, and this goes all the way back to the beginnings of Buddhism, the origins of Buddhism, Shakyamuni Buddha and the students, disciples, followers that gathered around him. At that time, they mostly practiced on their own. There weren't monasteries or temples like this. That was a later development in Buddhism. So in the early days, there were teachings. People would gather for teachings, but they would go off and do their meditation practice by themselves. They would do their other practices by themselves. But once a month, they would all get back together, and the intention of that meeting, I suppose, in addition to just giving each other moral support, which I imagine just quite naturally happened, was to confess, was actually to share with one another. I don't think confess in this way of like to feel terrible about oneself, but to actually share with your fellow practitioners, I think in an honest way, like, these are my shortcomings this month. This is where I had a really hard time. This is where I kind of messed up. So from the earliest days of Buddhism, this was a practice, was to meet together as a community and honestly share one's shortcomings in the practice with one another, to confess that. All these languages, the words are so loaded for us these days, but I think there's a way to engage them that's helpful, that doesn't need to carry off on the psychic baggage that it does. So they would confess, these shortcomings, and they would repent. They would actually, repent actually means pent is the root for pain. We all know re means again, so like to feel again the pain of having kind of messed up. It's kind of what repenting is, and so they would confess and repent and renew their vows. And this has been a practice of Buddhist practitioners from the earliest days of practice. And the vows have changed. In the early days, there were many, many rules that the monks followed, lay people, fewer. And then even for monastics, the kind of the guidelines, which kind of turned into precepts, and got kind of simplified. So in the Zen tradition, we have the Bodhisattva precepts. So we have three pure precepts: to avoid all evil, to do all good, and to support all beings. And we have 10 grave precepts, mostly admonitions to not do certain kinds of things that are damaging, but there's often a way to kind of frame them in positive language as well. And I won't go through the whole list. Maybe I should have made the whole list, but. And so as Bodhisattva practitioners, those of us who are, you know, we take these vows, we commit to these precepts. And then the full moon is the time each month where we do this very ancient traditional practice. We do it ritually. We don't, in some communities, I think there is an effort to actually, in an individual way, have people maybe meet before the ceremony and say, I could have conversations with one another about the precepts, but the ceremony is a ritual ceremony, but it includes these elements. It includes confession and repentance and offering homage to the Buddhas, renewal of the four Bodhisattva vows, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then committing again to the precepts, you know. So this is a monthly ceremony that happens at the full moon. So I was very aware of this last night, and I lived in a monastic situation for almost 25 years. So as I said, I did this with a community for many years, and it was one of the things I missed the most when I left. I remember that, like, seeing the full moon, you know, shortly after I left, and it was quite sad actually not to be with a community to do that ceremony. But in more recent years, I do it on my, I mean, there are now community opportunities for me to do it sometimes, but I also will do it on my own. I have an altar set up in my room, and I have the whole ceremony, you know, and I'll just, I'll be like the doshi, the officiating priest, and the, you know, I'll just do the whole ceremony by myself. I'll even put on, you know, the white kimono that I received when I was Shuso, the head monk. So when you become head monk, you get this white kimono, and then traditionally, only for the full moon ceremony, you put it on. It's like height of formality. You put on the white kimono. You put on what are called besu or tabi, these white footwear. So I, you know, I did this all, I will do this at home sometimes. I'll put on by myself the white besu and tabi, the white kimono, and I'll just do the ceremony by myself. And so I was thinking yesterday evening about whether I would do the ceremony, and I hadn't anticipated ahead of time that it was going to be the full moon. So I'm staying up in Berkeley. I live in Fresno. So I hadn't brought my white kimono with me. I hadn't brought my tabu, you know, my besu and tabi. So I couldn't do the whole dress up thing, but I could still, you know, and I hadn't brought my thing about the ceremony, but I could look it up easily enough. So I thought about doing it. And then something happened shortly before the moon. So I knew the full moon was going to be at 7:30. So I was thinking if I would do it, I would try and do it as close to the actual full moon as I could. And then at around 5 o'clock, I was straightening up in the kitchen. I don't think I was being obsessively orderly, but, you know, practicing the orderly ways I developed after all my years of Zen practice. And there was like something that it wasn't like a lot, but there was like something that I wanted to take out to the trash or the recycling. And I'm staying in a friend's house in Berkeley that I stay at frequently, but I usually stay in the main house, which is upstairs. But this time, for various reasons, I was staying downstairs in the basement. And so I went downstairs, which is closest to where the trash and the recycling is. And I took this thing to put, and then I turned around to go back into the house, and the door had closed behind me, and it had locked behind me. And I was like, I was in the kitchen in my bare feet and a t-shirt, you know, like I had my REI, you know, like sky blue, you know, self-wicking t-shirt and my black nylon, you know, Royal Robbins pants and no shoes and socks and no wallet, no keys, obviously, no phone, in a stranger, you know, I mean, in a friend's house, but not my house. And there was just, as you can, just like that moment of like realizing, like, oh, I'm locked out. I have nothing on me, nothing. Nothing to identify myself with, nothing to get myself back in the house, nothing it seemed like to get help with. I mean, because we think about, well, call, but I couldn't call. And I hadn't really started to work on the talk. So that was also what I was thinking. It's like, well, I'd set the evening aside to start to work on the talk, and now I'm locked out. And so I I came around the front of the house, and there happened to be just someone walking on the other side of the street. And I didn't think about it. I just like impulsively, kind of instinctively, just kind of yelled out, like, "Help! I don't know if you can help me, but I need some help." And who knows what the response was. But the woman was very kind, and she came over, and I explained what happened, and she called a locksmith. But before we could actually connect with the technician who would come out, because they needed to call us back, she wanted to kind of continue on her walk. She didn't want to just like wait with me. So she left with her phone. So I was again kind of back at just there at the house. I mean, I kind of trusted this woman that if they would call her and something would happen, but she was gone at that point. But then a few minutes later, she came back with another woman who lived closer to the house. I'm saying maybe five houses away. This woman lived much further away. And she said, "I'm going to hand you off to this other woman who can take care of you. You'll be in good hands." And so we called the locksmith, gave them the new number. Anyway, I don't really need to tell you the whole story. I kind of wanted to share the story because through the good relationships of what turned out to be three members of in this community, this woman who had just happened to be walking by, who didn't really even know this neighbor, they just kind of knew each other by face because she would walk by this other woman's house. They didn't actually have a personal relationship, but it was enough to say like, "Hey, there's this guy who needs help." And then, so this other woman started to help me. And then she had a list of neighbors of people in the neighborhood. And she started to wonder like, "Oh, I wonder if Varya is that my friend who lets me stay at her house. I wonder if Varya had gave a copy of the key to anyone else in the neighborhood." And that rang a bell for me. And so she went through the list of names, and there was a name that I recognized. And I think, "Oh, maybe it's Sally. Maybe Sally has a key." And so she called up Sally. And in fact, Varya had given Sally her car keys, and it had a house key on it. And she came back in and let me in. So it ended up being like no big deal. Like I got in less than an hour. But again, I guess it's like the experience, like partly as I'm telling this in the context of the moon, but also for me, there was not just metaphorical, not just symbolic, like it was real, meaning of having completely given up everything. I mean, we talk about Zen practice being a renuncia practice, letting go of everything, you know, in a certain way, being prepared to let go of everything, being prepared to renounce everything, not grasping anything, especially self and identity. And this was, you know, and as a priest, I took vows to this effect. I took home leaving vows, you know, which traditionally meant you're not a householder, you don't own a home. You're in a monastery or you're wandering on your own. You know, and we're not so clear about that yet, maybe here in America, but that this has historically been the practice, and these were the vows that I took, and I'm aware of that. And I felt it was only for like a short period of time, I felt like, oh, this is like, again, it's like with the heart thing. Like, this is the most stark reality of this. I mean, I kind of knew I would get taken care of eventually, but there was that, especially the instantaneous realization, like, I have nothing on me, not even an ID. You know, again, like in the metaphorical sense of that too, like, who am I in this situation? And why would anyone believe, given this, that I should be let in this? This is someone else's house. And there's no way for me to in any way prove that I should be let back into this house. And I'm totally at this point now dependent on others. Completely, again, like this is a Buddhist teaching, like this is always the reality, right? Our lives are always completely dependent on the support of others, or as kind of as I said at the beginning of the talk, the support of the entire universe. But mostly we don't see it that way. We think, there's someone over here, and I've got to take care of my life, and I've got to make it happen. And this was a situation where I could just like scratch at the walls. I couldn't do anything by myself. I was completely dependent in a very obvious way. And so beautifully, in a way that on the one hand felt a little, again, like synchronistic or coincidental, but in another way, obviously had to do with the good relations of people in that neighborhood and the good neighbors that they were to each other and the practices that they had established with one another, that I could so easily be supported to get back in, to find my way. in. So again, this carried a lot of meaning for me, like, wow, like, well, first of all, the experience of like realizing, like in that moment, like just the complete dependence on the universe, basically, like get me back in this house. And I, as you can imagine, I did start to feel my anxiety level like go up. Like some part of me rationally knew like, well, sooner or later, there'll be a way that I'll get back. But like, it wasn't clear at first how this was gonna happen. And you know, and there were things I was hoping to do. So the anxiety level was like going up. And I was thinking to myself, you just went through open heart surgery. Like, this is no big deal. Why are you getting so anxious? Why are you like starting to panic about this, you know? But anyway, it never went full blown panic. But like, there, and I think this is true. Like, I think to live with the reality of complete renunciation, complete opening our hands, of any grasping hands, hearts, minds, and the trust that requires, I think it's quite natural that there might be some terror that we would need to pass through to be able to actually live that way. So I had a little taste of that yesterday. But it, you know, all's well that ends well. But anyway, it put a little dent in my plans to maybe do the full moon ceremony by myself. I did go out later and try and find the triple moon, the harvest moon, the full moon, the blood moon, the super moon, but it was completely obscured by a thick blanket of clouds in the Berkeley sky. I must confess there was like maybe a little bit of longing to be able to see the moon, but I was kind of able to accept that I wasn't going to be able to see it, and somehow felt reassured knowing that even though there was this obscuring blanket of clouds, sea of clouds, on the other side of that sea of clouds, I knew there was this still fully shining, fully bright, fully illuminating moon. It was there, I knew it. What time are we supposed to wrap up? 10:02. So like a few more minutes then. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'll stop there. I had numerous Zen stories that I wanted to tell related to the moon. Well, how about I read? Okay, if people are willing to sacrifice time for Q&A, I could read. There was something I wanted to read from Suzuki Roshi. And I just, at Kanando, I just feel so close to Suzuki Roshi, because the chain of connection is so close. And maybe I'll read some words of Suzuki Roshi that, you know, have some reference to the moon. I need to find my glasses though first. I thought I lost them earlier, but I didn't. And I think I have them in my very long sleeves. So this is from Not Always So. So this is a collection of talks by Suzuki Roshi that was collected and edited by Ed Brown. And this is the next to last, I'm not gonna read the whole section, but this is from the next to last little piece in that book. And it's called Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. This is a koan. Some of you are nodding your heads. It's a very famous Zen koan. So these are also the Kyoshi's words. I'll just read from Not Always So. In the Blue Cliff Record, there is a koan concerning Basso Doitsu. Basso was big and physically very strong, a man of great stature. And I'll just say that Suzuki Roshi gave this talk just as he was recovering from an illness. I don't know how serious the illness was, but clearly he'd been in bed for a while. And he was just emerging from bed. His voice was just coming back. The parts of the talk before this kind of references, he's talking about this, like just starting to recover, and people being worried about him while he was sick. And I looked at the data, it's from 1969. So it was a couple of years before he died. So I don't know how serious this illness was. It wasn't the one that he ultimately died from, although by the end of the essay, he is talking about his own death. But anyway, so this is coming out of his own experience of having just been very ill. In the Blue Cliff record, there is a koan concerning Basso Doitsu. Basso was a big and physically very strong, a man of great stature. Once, when Basso was ill, the monk who took care of the temple came to visit him and asked, "How are you doing? Are you well or not?" And Basso said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." The sun-faced Buddha is supposed to live for 1,800 years. The sun-faced Buddha is supposed to live for 1,800 years. And the moon-faced Buddha lives only one day and one night. Very brief life. "When I am sick," says Suzuki Roshi, "I may be the moon-faced Buddha. When I'm healthy, I am the sun-faced Buddha. But the sun-faced Buddha or the moon-faced Buddha has no special meaning. Whether I am ill or healthy, I am still practicing zazen. There is no difference. Even though I am in bed, I am Buddha. So don't worry about my health." This is quite simple. Whatever happens to Basso, he can accept things as it is. This was a Suzuki Roshiism, one of his favorites. Things as it is. Whatever happens to Basso, he can accept things as it is. But we cannot accept everything. We may accept something we think is good, but if we dislike something, we won't accept it. And we compare things. He is a true Zen master. And he is not. Or he is a good Zen student, but I am not. That kind of understanding may be quite usual, but finally, that kind of understanding may be quite usual, but finally, you cannot figure out which idea is reliable. The point is to attain complete composure. Ordinary effort associated with comparative thinking will not help you. Ordinary effort associated with comparative thinking will not help you. To attain enlightenment means we have complete composure in our life without any discrimination. At the same time, this does not mean to stick to the attitude of non-discrimination, because that is also a kind of discrimination. I'll read this last paragraph again. The point is to attain complete composure. And I will preface, I'll edit, which means also composure sometimes with our lack of composure. Can we be composed with our lack of composure? The point is to attain complete composure. Ordinary effort associated with comparative thinking will not help you. To attain enlightenment means we have complete composure in our life without any discrimination. At the same time, this does not mean to stick to the attitude of non-discrimination, because that is also a kind of discrimination. So that was the Suzuki Roshi's words on sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And now I'm just going way overboard. I brought a poem to close with, and since I just read that, I'm just going to read the poem to close. Is that okay? So this is a poem by Mary Oliver called When Death Comes. The theme. When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, toward silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it is over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. Thank you all for your kind attention. Yeah, I'm happy to take questions.
Well, thank you for sharing such, yeah, such profound experience. I have three questions.
Yeah.
Comment, well, we respond. Yeah. But when I hear about you, I don't feel suffering, and you were absorbed by the pain. And then I didn't see suffering is able to to insert it in your mind. You just be with that every moment. You know, your surgery, your procedures, your doctors, everything. You know, there's no suffering. You know, I hear pain. I didn't hear suffering. I'm not sure. You know, that's what I hear. You know, and. So, well, no, I'm just basically, because we talk about so much thing about suffering,
yeah,
but I didn't hear suffering. I hear pain.
Right.
You know, so I just won't mention that. And
yeah.
Then and then you also mentioned that you often read Suzuki's comments really wrong. You said, oh, you are you, and Zen is Zen, and then now you realize it's becoming.
Yeah.
I think sounds like you're extending your awareness really spacious, right? So you are aware that you are not yourself. You're pretty aware, right? So I think my question is, typically, what do you observe you're not you. So basically, typically, what is between you and then yourself? You know, typically,
yeah.
You know, during that process, you're becoming you, but for that, during that becoming, and then what do you meet? You know, several layers sometimes, you know, just curious. And my third comment is about the end, because I love Matu.
Yeah.
I love him, and also tell everybody, because in China this trip I just coincidentally encounter his dojo.
Oh, wow.
And I have no idea.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's amazing. So that's why I have to. This is a thrill. It's really ordinary. No tourists.
Uh-huh.
No tourists.
Wow.
You know, and completely normal. Everybody is so normal, you know. And anyway, when I heard you talk about this, Suzuki's comments, actually,
yeah.
about that, it sounds like Suzuki is dropping the concept of equanimity. So he said, or even the thought about non-discriminate is a suffering. Right?
To hold the
Yeah,
attitude of
even so.
non-discrimination is a mistake because that in itself is a kind of discrimination.
Yeah,
The line of
it's basically it's a
yeah.
concept, right? It's a concept.
Right. Non-discrimination can become a concept that we grasp
Right, so that's so you drop, and now we finally find a concept to describe our suffering, and now we're about to drop that concept, you know? So just I know you've been practicing for pretty deep for long, and then just have some comments about your dropping of this concept, including those Buddhist beautiful concepts, including your philosophy, you
Yeah,
know?
so the, and I think it's a very important distinction between pain and suffering. And I think it's maybe like the key distinction in Buddhism in terms of the, to use a fancy word, like the soteriological purpose of practice, is to relieve us of suffering with the understanding that we cannot be relieved of pain, completely relieved of pain in our human life. There will be pain. There will be pain in human life. But there's a way to live that that isn't suffering. I think that's a very key distinction, and that's why I said I thought it was so beautiful that you heard that in my story. I don't know if it's completely true. Yeah, right. And I'm already forgetting this. And the last thing was this thing about like something about what I want to say about dropping the idea of non-discrimination. Like, what's the practice of that? Like, something like that. How does one do that? And then remind me what the thing in the middle was. I had it.
And in the middle is what is between.
Oh, right. That was also
What is
beautiful.
between.
Yeah. So in terms of that, like, what's between you? So when you become you, Zen becomes Zen. So what happens in that maybe endless process of becoming? Let's say, what is it that prevents you from being you? And how? And what do you need to move through to become who you really are? And my impulse is to say, like, I think that's best answered by each of us studying that for ourselves. I mean, I could say some things about it, and I could say some things about, my own experience, but I feel like that's maybe like to study the Buddha way is to study the self, right? Dogen, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So I think this is maybe like the key thing. What's preventing us, and what do we need to move through to become who we really are? I mean, when you asked the question, I was also thinking again about the maze procedure, because I think like there is some quality of we get out of sync, we get out of rhythm of who we are. This is just a metaphor, obviously. And then if we're lucky, maybe we get wounded enough that we get jarred out of that. But this is part of what was metaphorical about. Then we're like kind of put into a maze. We're kind of put into a labyrinth. So part of what I want to say that we move through, this isn't so much the experience, but it may be a bit like being in a maze or being in a labyrinth. For you to become you need to move through this maze. You need to move through this labyrinth of your life. Yeah, but there are various things that you encounter on the way, but maybe that's for you to find out. What do you encounter as you become you? Yeah, symbolic, right? And then something about dropping the concept of non-discrimination. So I was thinking about this because I knew I was gonna, I thought I might talk about this during the talk, and I was like, do I even know how I would want to talk about what that is? And I mean, I was actually thinking about this kind of very point to some degree. So what was coming to mind was like, I was thinking, because I even wondered, like, well, what is non-discrimination? What does he mean? What is non-discrimination? And what does it mean to like practice non-discrimination but not cling to non-discrimination? Because like you do need to like look both ways before you cross the street, right? So two things kind of come to mind. So one is like, and this is like a practical thing that I think we might all notice, like in doing practice, there's something about practice that I think supports us moving into like a more intuitive space that gives us access to a bigger vision of the universe and a bigger vision of our life, that isn't so preoccupied. When I think of discrimination, there are of course many kinds of ways that we make discriminations, but I think the ones from a Buddhist point of view that are so pernicious, but that are so common in our culture, it's like our cultures are organized around like, is this good for me, or is it not good for me? Like most of us, many of us, I mean, I'm talking about myself, you know, go about our days, like most of the time, like, is this good for me, is this not good for me? Right, that's the discrimination we're kind of like hung up on. And again, like he's not saying, well, come, you know, don't cling to non-discrimination, but like if you only live in that place, that's suffering. I think that's pretty clear. Because you're not going to win that one. Death will come. So one idea of non-discrimination is having a bigger view than that, a bigger view of your life than just what's good for me, what's not good for me. And then another way of saying that, which, you know, can be a Zen cliche, but I feel like it's also the realest thing if you can realize it, is like wholeheartedness. I think wholeheartedness is non-discrimination. You're not divided in any way. You're completely committed to this. And this, you know, might be everything. You know, you're completely committed to this moment after moment. But I think part of that wholeheartedness is like, there are no signs. It's a signless realm. You can't say if you're in it or you're not in it. So if you're saying, well, that's non-discrimination, there are no signs to indicate that you're doing non-discrimination. So you kind of have to drop like being in non-discrimination because you'll never know. Yeah, kind of dissolves, because it basically this is about moving beyond concepts.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.